The fact that Jesus could and very often did punctuate his teaching with very vivid illustrations that would capture our imagination and really teach us some lessons that we really need to focus upon. And that's exactly what he did in this lesson that we just read, right, beginning at verse 19 and going through verse 31. Jesus would often tell some compelling stories, and he did at this occasion. This story that he read here is just one of many stories that Jesus told and is often referred to as the story of the rich man and Lazarus. Now, it's a simple story. Now, when the brother was reading that, if we followed along with that reading, then we just fully understood many of the things that were being said there by our Lord. It's not something that is very complicated. As a matter of fact, I would say that many of the young children in this assembly this morning have studied the story of the rich man and Lazarus in their Bible classes. And they many times would come away with a great many lessons from that story. It's a simple story. It's an easy story to read, an easy story to understand. But that being said, we have to also acknowledge that not only is it a simple story, it is a story that is shrouded in a great deal of mystery and intrigue. For example, as we begin to look at that story that Jesus told, the first thing that comes to our mind is Jesus just giving us a parable? You know, a parable was a story that Jesus would use something in life to make a spiritual point. And it doesn't necessarily have to be, something that's going to be literally understood. Is this a parable? You know, many of our religious neighbors look at this and say, well, this is a parable. Jesus is not teaching anything about punishment or torment after death. It's just a story that he told that's a parable. There's no real truth to it. Well, is it a parable? Well, you know, it may have some characteristics of a parable, but it's not called a parable. Luke doesn't begin his story by saying, and Jesus spoke to them a parable saying. He doesn't say that. It just begins, and there was a certain rich man. And when we look at that, we'd have to say, well, it really doesn't have a great deal of parabolic characteristics. It may look like a parable in some ways. It started like a parable in chapter 16 and verse 1. There was a certain rich man. But it doesn't have a great many parabolic characteristics with it. And so as a result of that, I fall down on the side that Jesus is not giving a parable. This is not a parable like the prodigal son. This is a story that Jesus is telling that needs to capture our imagination and make some serious lessons out of it. So no, I don't think that it's a parable. But again, another mystery about that is, why is only one name given? Now, I know besides the name of Abraham, Abraham is mentioned there, but in the far as the two characters in the story are concerned, only one name is given, not two. We know the name of the poor man. His name was Lazarus. Now, of course, this is not the same Lazarus that we read about, who was the brother of Mary and Martha, who died, that Jesus was raised from the dead. This is another Lazarus. And the name Lazarus means one whom God helps. But the other man is unnamed. We do not know the name of the rich man. Now, if you're looking in some old commentaries, you may see that he is referred to by the name or by the word dives. Well, that is not his name. That just simply is a word that means rich. He is a rich man. We don't know what his name is. We don't know the name of his family. However, the Jews thought that he was Phineas. They referred to him as Phineas. And even the Egyptians would refer to him as Amenophis. But we don't know what his name was. We don't know at all. Somebody said one time that maybe he is unnamed because his name is not recorded in the portals of heaven. That may be so. His name is not recorded in heaven because we're going to see that he is in torment. So you see, these are some mysteries surrounding that. Another mystery has to do with the difference in the word Hades and hell. If you're reading in the old King James Version, you'll see that he was in hell and he lifted up his eyes. However, some other translations use the term Hades. And Hades is the original Greek word that's under consideration here. Hades was a place where the spirit of the dead go immediately upon death. It goes to the realm of the unseen. So the body goes back to the ground, and the spirit living on in the image of God, the spirit living on is immortal, and it goes into the realm of Hades awaiting the resurrection from the dead. Now in Hades there is also paradise. You remember what Jesus said to the thief on the cross in Luke chapter 23 and verse 43, "Today you will be with me in paradise." Well, Peter makes it plain in his sermon in Acts 2 and verse 27 that upon the death of Jesus, he went into Hades and his soul was not left in Hades. Well, we know that Jesus went into paradise because that's where he said to the thief that you'll be with me. But also, in the realm of Hades, there's a place that's called torment or a place of torment. This is where the rich man was. He was being tormented in a flame. And so we see that Hades has both paradise and torment. Hell, on the other hand, translates the Greek word Gehenna, and it was a place that was prepared for the devil and his angels, Matthew 25 and verse 41. It is a place of eternal torment. It is a place that one will not leave to go to the resurrection. It is a place that one will go in after the judgment. And so when we look at the parable, we recognize that it, or look at the story rather, we recognize that it is not a parable. We recognize that it's shrouded with some kind of mystery. And so while it may be simple on the, you know, at the first reading, there's a great deal of intrigue about it. But you know what I want to do? I want to look at this story, the story of the rich man and Lazarus, I want to look at it from a different perspective maybe than you have examined it before. And I want to look at it as a family record. Because you see, what we see in the story that Jesus gives is really the story of a family. It is the record of a family. Now, I know it has a lot to do with Lazarus. I understand that it has a lot to do with Abraham and all that's involved there. But it also contains a family record. Now, we don't know the name of the family. We don't know, where the family lived or such things that might interest us, but we can learn a great deal about the family. Let me show you what I'm talking about here. I can remember as a boy going to my grandparents' house, and they had a large family Bible. Maybe you've seen these large family Bibles you set on the table. Well, my grandmother and granddad kept that family Bible on the mantelpiece in one of the rooms. And when I would go down to their house, I loved to get down that big family Bible. It had a lot of pictures in it of artist renditions of Bible characters and so forth. I enjoyed looking at those. But also in the middle of this Bible, between the Old and the New Testaments, would have you'd open it up and it'd have the family record. And it had the names of my mother's family listed there. It had her parents' name, my grandparents, and the day that they married. And then it began to list all eight of their children that were born, four boys and four girls. And I looked down, and there at about number four was my mother's name listed. And it's always interested me. And then you turn the page, and you can see the births of the marriages of the children and the births of the grandchildren. And I looked down, and yeah, there would be my name. And so this interested me. It was a family record. You know, family records at one time were used as a legal document. If you wanted to be, you know, you had no birth certificate, probably a child was born at home, but if it was recorded in the family record, then it was recognized as a legal birth. Well, what we have here is the family record. And I want to look at this family record, and I'm going to make some points out of this. And then I'm going to make some applications that I believe are going to be very pertinent for each and every one of us. So let me direct your attention back to the 16th chapter of the book of Luke, the story of the rich man and Lazarus. And one of the first things that we recognize about this family record, it is a wealthy family. It would have been a record book that was gold lined. This represents a wealthy family. The Bible says there was a certain rich man. God called him rich. And he was a man that was clothed in purple and fine linen. The idea of being clothed in purple and fine linen is that this is a representative of wealth and royalty. You look back in the Old Testament in the book of Judges, chapter 8 and verse 26, you'll see that the kings of Midian were dressed in purple. And Daniel, when he interpreted the dream or the handwriting on the wall of Belshazzar, he was given a third of the kingdom and he was clothed in a purple robe. That's wealth and that is royalty. So this is what we see in this family. It was a family that was wealthy. It was a family that was faring sumptuously every day. You have any idea what that means? You have any idea what it means to fare sumptuously every day? It means that they could eat what they wanted. It means they could buy whatever they desired to buy. It meant that money was no object. They fared sumptuously every day, much like Solomon wrote about in the Ecclesiastes chapter 2 and verse 10. He said, "Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure." This would have been descriptive of this family. It was an extremely wealthy family. It was a family that could do anything and have anything that their hearts would have desired. They could have had the most, they could have had the best. They lacked for nothing. But now let me stop right here and say something that may be on your mind. If you're saying, J.R., are you implying that he wound up where he did because he was wealthy? The answer to that is no. He did not end up where he was simply because he came from a wealthy family. That's not what this is about. As a matter of fact, the story is not that simple. And the reason that I say that is because there are many godly people revealed to us in the Bible who were extremely wealthy, and they were able to serve God faithfully even in their wealth. Job is a man that comes to mind. Job was the wealthiest man in all that region during his day, and he was a faithful man of God. God said, "There's none like my servant Job." So Job was a wealthy man who served God. Wealth does not, in and of itself, mean that one is going to be lost. Not only do we read about Job, there was Abraham. Abraham was extremely wealthy. Get into the New Testament, you find Philemon and Lydia were wealthy individuals who had a desire to love and to serve God. This was a wealthy family. But I'll tell you one thing about wealth sometimes gives us a false sense of security. You remember Luke chapter 12 and verse 19, the rich fool said, looked at all that he had. He said, "I have many possessions laid up for many years. I'll say to my soul, eat, drink, and be merry. I'm okay. Everything is fine. No, wealth will sometimes give you a false sense of security. It might have given this man that false sense of security. I don't know. Wealth also has a way of blinding us to our spiritual needs because we're able to accumulate so much. Jesus said in explaining the parable of the sword, Matthew chapter 13 and verse 22, he said that the deceitfulness of riches will choke out the word. Maybe this man was deceived by his riches. I don't know. They have the power to deceive. Maybe he had a false sense of security. Maybe he thought that because he was wealthy, he'd just live on. And, you know, wealth will do that sometimes. It often causes us to forget, and it'll cause us to deny God. The proverb writer said in Proverbs 30 and verse 9, "Feed me with the food allotted to me, lest I be full and deny you." But what I want you to see is, it was a wealthy family. We're going to come back to that in a moment. But as we turn the page in this family record, we find that not only was it a wealthy family, it was a large family. This man said, "I have five brothers." So we know at least there were six boys in this family. Now, the Bible very often did not enumerate the daughters or the girls, the females, or even the children. It would just represent, it just designate those that would represent the heads of the household. So we know there were at least six boys in this family, and a mother and a father. Perhaps there were that many sisters. We don't know. Were there spouses to the boys? Were they married? Did they have children? Were there grandchildren in this family? But whatever it was, we know that there was a fairly large family, even with just the six boys. I don't know about you. I didn't come from a very large family. My mother did, and her parents did, but I didn't. But I tell you what, I enjoy being around large families because they're very often very loving and caring, and the banquets are big, and the dinners are amazing. And I believe that in this family, not only was it a large family, but I tend to think they were close. You see, later on, he's concerned about his brothers. You're not concerned about someone you don't feel a closeness to. He was concerned. And I love to see large families that do not lose that concern over the years. You ever notice how that happens? You ever notice how sometimes, you know, especially like when mom and dad pass on, and there is some sort of small inheritance that's left to the children, and that will cause sometimes brothers and sisters who have heretofore been close to one another that have a falling out with each other. You know, they'll even contest a will. I tell people this is ridiculous. We are a family, and we ought to do everything we can to pursue peace within our family. And I think this is what was occurring here. I think this was a close family. I don't think there was any falling out. And we're going to come back to this idea in just a moment. Keep in mind, as we're looking at this family record, we're looking at various aspects of this family. It was a wealthy family. And you put that down. You know what? That interests us. It really does. And don't, you know what? Why else would somebody like the Kardashians be on TV if we were not intrigued by wealth? You know? And so it's a wealthy family. But it's also a large family. And a family that was close. But I want to turn the book once, I want to turn the page once more, and I want to show you something now that will get our attention. It was a family that had a loved one to die. The rich man also died, and the Bible says was buried. Now just stop and consider this for a moment. All of the money that they had could not buy off death. The size of that family could not prevent death from intruding and stealing from that family a loved one. This is what I want you to see. You know, sometimes we get this false sense of security. We look at everything that we have, and we look at the camaraderie that we have within our family, and we get this idea that it's going to be this way forever. It's not. And it wasn't here. This family now had to go to the cemetery and bury a loved one. The size of the family and the wealth of that family could not prevent death. Death plays no favorites. Hear me this morning, ladies and gentlemen. Death plays no favorites. As a matter of fact, the Bible tells us in Numbers 16 and verse 29 that death is the common fate of all men. Do you realize, maybe you've seen these statistics, do you realize that 107 people die every minute on this earth? That is in an average. That's 153,000 that die every day. 56 million people die every year. And the size of their families and the wealth of those families and whatever the popularity and the prestige of those families could not prevent that. And you know what? I'm going to tell you right now. It's not going to prevent death from invading your family if it hasn't already done so. This is why Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 2 reminds us that it's better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and the living will lay it to his heart. It's time that we realized and understood that. And I'm going to tell you something else about it, ladies and gentlemen. When we talk about death invading a family, it changes things. Things will never be the same again. Going home will not be the same. Family reunions will not be the same. Holidays and birthdays will not be the same. And you know why? Because death has invaded and taken from us a loved one. And I tell you, I think about this. I realize, I understand that death is a step that we take into eternity, that without death we cannot enter into eternity. I understand that. I respect that. But at the same time, I look at death from the perspective of those who are left behind. And this is why I believe that the face of death is a horrible face. That's why the Bible refers to death as the King of Terrors. The Bible refers to death as the rider of the pale horse. The Bible refers to death as the enemy of Christ. And anything that's described as the King of Terrors or the enemy of Christ does not have a pretty face upon it. And I am not one of these preachers that will read these very flowing poets or poetries about death. Death is hideous. Coffins come in all sizes. And I've been to funerals of little bitty babies that did not even have a chance to live very long upon this earth. And I look at the brokenhearted parents who are burying that child. Death will visit our families. It will take from us our father, our mother, our spouse, our son, our daughter, a grandchild. And the family circle will be broken. And going home will never be the same. There's an old spiritual that was out several years ago. It's entitled, "Are All the Children In?" And it goes like this. I think oft times as the night draws nigh of an old house on the hill, of a yard all wide and blossom-starred, where the children played at will. And when the night at last came down hustling the merry din, mother would look around and ask, "Are all the children in?" 'Tis many and many a year since then, and the old house on the hill no longer echoes to childish feet, and the yard is still, so still. But I see it all. As the shadows creep and through many, though many the years have been, since then I can still hear my mother ask, "Are all the children in?" This mother of this boy could not say that all of her children were in, because she's made a trip to the cemetery. So it's a family that's a large family, a wealthy family, and a family that was visited by death. A loved one died. And now we're going to turn the page and we're going to see something very tragic about that. Not only had that loved one died lost. And being in torments in Hades, he lifted up his eyes. And I want you to know, my friends, that was never going to change. Let's continue looking at this. He said in verse 24, "Father Abraham, have mercy on me." This is the boy who died. This is the boy whose wealth could not prevent his death. "Father Abraham, have mercy on me and send Lazarus that he may dip the tip of his finger in water, cool my tongue, for I'm tormented in this flame." But Abraham said, "Son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things and likewise Lazarus' evil things, but now he is comforted and you're tormented. And besides," you need to know something, "between us and you there's a great gulf fixed." That's a wide, wide area. You're not going to cross it. It's fixed. "There's a great gulf fixed so that those who want to pass from here to you, perhaps to give you some water, cannot. Nor can those